Yes, I'm putting a timer to not to waste too much of your time. First off, I'd like to thank Peter Stokes for this organization and for providing such an occasion to have people encounter from different environments. The environment where I come from, well, I'll be speaking in English, like you already understood. I'm sorry about that, but je pensais que c'est toujours mieux un bon anglais qu'un mauvais français, to be more understandable. So what I do, I used to be a Latinist. I'm not sure if I still am. I am a Latinist. I do digital editions. I'm currently publishing Priscian, the most exciting text of the Latin literature, a grammar book, with the Lachmanian edition. But I've been working on digital scholarly editions in the last years. One of the things I've been mostly interested in is the idea of graphemes, that is encoding manuscripts, which is at the basis of philology. So basically, I'm a digital philologist. So I created an ontology, yet another ontology. It's called POGO because I thought it sounded very cool. POGO is the philology-oriented graphematics ontology. Basically, it includes those concepts, that is, objects in an ontology, which a digital philologist needs to transcribe a textual document. So imagine I have to create a critical edition, digital edition of something, or a corpus of documents, papyri as well as manuscripts, as well as inscriptions, and I'm transcribing them. What objects do I need? The concept of character comes from print. It's not enough for our writing systems. And today this is more in the fashion because HDR, handwritten text recognition, OCR for manuscripts, is providing us with an easier way to get transcriptions of primary sources. My focus personally is on medieval manuscripts. So the ontology is already online, although it's a draft, and I'll be very happy to hear your feedback and to discuss this, etc. It's on the VDPH GitHub, because this is the Venice Center for Digital and Public Humanities, where I was a visiting scholar in 2019 and 2020, where I elaborated this. So I have to thank them for the funding and to mention them, very, very willingly, though. So why yet another ontology? This is a good question, not easy to answer. No, maybe there's no need for a new one. The point is that I think that getting our concepts straight and getting our concept in a formal way, defining them in a formal way so that the computer can learn it, is a way to achieve a number of goals. First off, we can try to combine digital paleography and digital philology. So getting straight what a grapheme is, what an allographeme is, even if we call them by different names in different ontologies, we can still connect one ontology to the other, like I'm going to say in a minute, as long as we have this conversation about what a grapheme is. For me, for someone doing Hebrew philology, for someone doing hieroglyphics philology. Also, I hope that we can achieve a better interoperability among one digital scholarly edition and another. And I will try to provide a practical example of this in a minute. This is technical talk here. There are ontologies already, and I am anchoring my ontology to those existing ones. Basically, I'm reusing two concepts, grapheme and glyph, from the CRM text ontology, which is an expansion of CDoc CRM. I told you this was technical talk, but CDoc CRM is the big one ontology in the humanities and, you know, cultural heritage, and CRM text is the expansion of CDoc CRM for text, ancient text. So I'm starting from two concepts, grapheme and glyph, that they already defined. I include them in my ontology, and I further classify those concepts and create new concepts and new relationships. Two closely related ontologies are Peter Stokes' archetype ontology, so we're not competing. I am reusing some of his concepts. I also connecting some of my concepts to their concepts in a formal way, which can be done in the ontology approach. It's not one ring to conquer them all. It's a pluralistic approach. We can create different ontologies and say, my grapheme is your ontograph. They correspond to each other. And the other one is Typo O by Friederike Neuber, which, however, is on print. But I'm still mostly working, I'm entirely working on handwriting, which is way more complex than print, like we all know. Not so sure, huh? Okay. This is the archetype ontology talking about complexity. And this is the concept of grapheme coming from CDoc CRM. So this area is the area where I more or less am. But my interest is on the syntagmatic axis, one character after the other in a text. His interest is on the paradigmatic axis, which is A, B, C within the same system. I think this can be complementary. That's one of the reasons why I'm here. Assuming there is a reason why I'm here. But anyway, thank you for inviting me. I hope it does have sense. So let's jump straight into the matter. This is a piece of my ontology. What I'm doing now is not exposing all of it, because it's long, but I chose some concepts, some key concepts to discuss with you. Well, the first big opposition is grapheme allograph. They have been called in many different ways in different presentations today, but this is one key distinction. I consider writing systems as a separate semiotic system. So I respect the language, that step on the ladder. There is obviously a relationship between spoken language and written language, but if you do graphology and graphematics and philology, well, I do Latin, which is, how was Latin pronounced in the Middle Ages? In Spain and in Italy. Can we say it was an oral language? Definitely. Should we anchor our work to how Latin was pronounced in the 10th century in Sicily? No. So we're doing philology. We're working on with written texts. So to me, writing systems are independent semiotic systems. So in that semiotic system, the minimal distinctive unit is a grapheme, or like Peter Stokes calls it, an ontograph. Again, we can discuss this. It's the minimal distinctive unit. There's something that Tito Orlandi, I've been working with, doesn't like about this. I say that we cannot distinguish among graphemes if we don't use the concept of meaning, like you said earlier. But I think that there's no other way to say that. A grapheme is someone that makes a distinction in meaning, whatever meaning means. So, su and ku are distinguished by C, S, K. So these two signs are graphematic because they distinguish between two words that have a different meaning. Instead, su and su, written with two different signs like short s and long s, they are the same. They have the same meaning. There's always some meaning. There always is some meaning. There's a reason why you use an elaborated allograph or another allograph, but on a different layer. On the linguistic layer, they're the same word. So I call these allographs. Pogo allograph is one of my concepts. And this is grapheme taken from Sidok's theorem. So I myself call glyph, which others have called mark today, those signs. If I write a long S 100 times, in my definition, I will have 100 different glyphs. You cannot write twice the same sign, the same glyph. This comes from Sidok's theorem. Then a glyph means an allograph, long S. All these glyphs mean the same allograph, which is the abstract model, long S. And both allographs mean the same grapheme, which is different from C. How does this kind of distinctions help us achieve practical interoperability? By interoperability, I mean that I create a critical edition, Arianna Ciulla will create another digital edition. How can we have them work together? How can we put them in the same corpus and search through the corpus, for example? How can we collate two transcriptions of Priscian's Ars Grammatica? I imagine a situation in which I have, say, Ovid's Metamorphoses in manuscript A and manuscript B. I have handwritten text recognition software creating an automatic transcription. That transcription will make a difference between short S and long S, probably. They will make a distinction between this allograph and this allograph for you. Now, if I only have this transcription, I cannot collate the two texts. Or if these are two documents in a corpus, if I search for unus, the software will not find either of them because I will probably type something like this. However, if I attach a table of signs to each transcription, like Tito Orlandi suggests, but the idea of having them machine actionable is mine. He doesn't agree, I have to say, because he told me I don't agree with that part. So those who know Tito Orlandi know that he doesn't agree with a lot of things, so I shouldn't really say this. No, anyway, apart from the jokes. Imagine I have this transcription and I attach a table of signs in which I formally make a distinction between graphemes and allographs. So I say that, what is it? I have a list of all graphemes. I have a list of allographs corresponding to each grapheme. Each one of them is a Unicode character. This is all formalized. The software can easily understand that this allograph corresponds to this grapheme, that this allograph corresponds to this grapheme. So the software can easily produce a graphematic transcription, a graphematic layer that will be useful for collation, for search, etc. What's at the basis of, and this solves the problem that was being mentioned earlier today, that how, in hieroglyphics, for example, shall we transcribe variants, shall we transcribe abstract models? This is a false problem in the human, I mean, it's a problem because it takes a lot of time, but conceptually this can be solved in the digital environment as long as we make a formal, make a conceptual distinction and then a formal computational distinction between allographs and graphemes. So there's nothing as practical as good theory, like to quote. This is an example of what I mean by interoperability by means of good modeling. So let's go back to the ontology. The key concept is obviously the concept of grapheme. I made a classification of graphemes based on Geoffrey Sampson, writing systems, who's a genius, as long as he doesn't talk about very controversial topics, such as racism. But in terms of linguistics, he was very controversial at some point, but I agree with what he says in linguistics and in semiotics. So I use his terminology, but the good part about ontologies is that this is just a code. It's just a number. So I can say this, which I called gottographic, corresponds to what you call in a different way. So as I was saying, but this will be too long to explain. Basically, semasiographic graphemes are ideographs. Textual graphemes are a strange thing I invented for punctuation signs, for example, which make a difference, so I call them graphemes, but they don't make a difference in the word, in the language. They make a difference in the whole text. Having a comma or not having a comma, okay, never mind. What I'm going to talk to you about is glottographic graphemes, which are the ones that have to do with language, that express the language or the words, whatever a word is. So, since we are talking about pre-modern writing systems, things are more complicated than just characters in a row. That comes after Gutenberg, and then goes into the digital encoding of text and Unicode. Let's make an example. Glottographic graphemes can be phonographic graphemes, letters expressing sounds, so to speak, and logographs. A logograph, I define, well, Geoffrey Sampson defines a logograph, a grapheme, so one sign, which describes a whole word, as opposed to a semasiogram, which expresses a which expresses a concept. So numbers 1, 2, 3, they accept a concept. Because if I write 2, say du, it's uno, it's due, it's 2 in different languages, it's a concept of 2. Whereas this grapheme here in medieval Latin manuscripts is one sign, but it expresses a word, not a concept. The Latin word for third-person singular indicative, est. He is, she is. So this is not an E, this is not an S, this is not a T. It's not a combination of such. I know that paleographers will tell me originally it was a ligature, it comes from a combination, but the way the scribe perceives it, I say, it's one sign, which expresses one word. So this is one concept that doesn't no longer exist in print except for incunabula and early scripts. Then this is the area of segmental graphemes in which we have things that have to do with the alphabet. But then again, in medieval manuscripts and also in Arabic script, etc., etc., things are more complicated than we think they are. Well, the alphabetic, what I call alphabetic graphemes, are A, B, C, D, E, corresponding to letters, which can be in different alphabets, alpha, beta, gamma, aleph, etc. But then again, I make a distinction, this is controversial, I know, between alphabetic grapheme and alphabeme. By alphabeme, I mean a more abstract concept, which is the alphabetic letter. Why? Because, okay, you tell me, please, what you think about this, because I'm certainly not sure about this. But my idea is this. S is Latin letter S. It can be meant, it can be expressed by grapheme S. It can be expressed by beep, 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 if I'm on a telegraph with a Morse code. It can be expressed by, listen, S. So the sound S, S-P-E-L-L-I, okay, when I say S, I'm expressing the letter S. I can also express the letter S with the grapheme S. So since I think there is a relationship between the abstract concept and a number of ways I can express it, and we will go to medieval abbreviations, by the way, which are another way to express letters, which is non-alphabetic necessarily, then I think that there are different concepts, but I'm not sure. So the relationship would be like this in my ontology. In an ontology, you have concepts, and you have relationships between those concepts, and also the relationships are formalized. So I invented a new relationship, which is has alphabetic meaning. So an alphabetic grapheme such as C has alphabetic meaning to one and one only alphabetic letter, C. So C means C, simply. One grapheme means one alphabeme. So in other words, we used to have the glyphs, the allographs, the grapheme, and to me, this grapheme means Latin S. I think that this makes sense in medieval handwriting when we go to abbreviations. And this is useful in medieval handwriting because, yes, I have another concept, which is the concept of abbreviation mark. So a macron or this colon-like abbreviation sign, these are combining signs. Okay, what happens is that one alphabetic grapheme, such as E, combines with the abbreviation mark, such as the macron. So the relationship in ontology terms is part of. So one alphabetic grapheme is part of only one abbreviation. One abbreviation mark is part of only one abbreviation. So the abbreviation is another concept. Why am I making this a concept in my ontology? Because I think that it is the abbreviation combination that has an alphabetic meaning. I cannot say that this macron means M, canem. So M is meant by the macron, because the macron in a different context with other signs means other things. So the macron does not have an alphabetic meaning. So I think that what happens is that the whole combination of an alphabetic grapheme and abbreviation mark has an alphabetic meaning. And this alphabetic meaning goes to two or more alphabemes. So that's why you need a distinction between alphabetic grapheme and alphabeme. So in this case, this plus this create an abbreviation which has alphabetic meaning, EM, and now EM are two letters. So in this case, I don't have one grapheme, one letter, like with print, like in Unicode. I have a more complex situation which I need to model. The last definition I'm going to give you, because yes, as you see, I have a number of concepts around here, including ligature, but another concept I'm going to define, if you're still with me, is the idea of brevigraph. I know that the words change, vary between different milieu scientifique, I call a brevigraph one grapheme, a unique grapheme, a global grapheme, not composed of other parts, which means more than one alphabetic letters. Like this is the Latin abbreviation for pro. You can tell me that the tail is another component. It is another component from a certain point of view. But I think that when it joins together into this brevigraph, it becomes one grapheme, which altogether means PRO. So, for example, what we have a different situation. A grapheme, an alphabetic grapheme, is one entity, which means one alphabetic letter, alphabeme. Whereas a brevigraph is, again, one grapheme, which means two or more alphabetic letters or alphabemes. Is this relevant or not? These are my conclusions. Is this relevant or not? Because I know we have practical solutions to encode abbreviations. However, I think that people working with different writing systems, such as Hebrew or hieroglyphic, or people working with Sumeric scripts, non-alphabetical languages, they know they have a problem. But since we work with Latin and Greek, which we think are entirely alphabetical, we think we don't have a problem. Now, I want to convince my colleagues that we do have a problem. I want to convince my colleagues that we need a more complex model, because what happens in medieval handwriting and in inscriptions and in papyri is more complex than print, than the simplification introduced by print. This is one of my manuscripts, which I like, because the writer was clearly a psychopath and an artist, and he has Santa Brigitta, please help me, whatever, every second page, and I love him very much. This is an insular script of the Ars Grammatica by Priscian from St. Gallen. Now, I chose a piece full of abbreviations, but this is, I swear, the first page that I opened of the manuscript popped up in the PDF. Okay, non potest, pot est, in veni, okay, non potest, comma, in veni mus enim loco, this comes from above, loco, adverbi nomen. Look at nomen. He's obviously talking about nouns, adverbs, so it just needs an O. Okay, This is an abbreviation, what I call abbreviation, a combination of signs, non. This is the same sign that we have here. Here it means on. Here it means omen. No, they don't mean, here it does not mean non. Here it does not mean nomen. It's the combination of those two signs and the combination of those three signs, which mean a sequence of alpha beams. This is a brevigraph because it's only used as an abbreviation for verb to be. Potest is a compound verb, pot, sum. If he has restum, it does not abbreviate est with this because it's not verb to be. So it's a logograph, really, or a brevigraph. This is a regular abbreviation. This is a logograph. Logograph. It's a sign which means one word, enim. I know that all of these things come from old ligatures, but a scribe in the 9th century writing this does not know this. He learns to write like this. He learns Latin should be written like this. And this is so rational, so practical, so compact, so intelligent, because this is always enim, this is always verb to be. You cannot write like this if you don't know Latin. I want to write insular when I write Latin. So this is a different way of writing the language that I learned as a system. So I'm saying more than half of those characters, I guess 21 to 18, are involved in some sort of, say, abbreviation. Now, when you have something which is more than a half of the alphabetic letters, can you call this a weird, strange feature? It's structural. It's part of how they wrote the language. It's non-entirely alphabetic. So I think that a model like this is necessary to model the complexity of medieval handwriting. Now, some open issues, in addition to many others which are still open, assuming that this is something that makes sense to work on, the distinction between alphabeam and grapheme, I know it's very complicated. The opposite stand, which Raul Mordenti, an Italian digital humanist, maintains, for example, is that there's no need to distinguish them, because in the mind of a person, there's always a grapheme. Even the Morse code, beep, 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 is a way to represent a grapheme, he says. I know this is very academic and very theoretical, but we are at the Collège de France, so we can ask theoretical questions. I mean, where else? So I know this is a problem to me, because entia non sunt multiplicanda praeter necessitatem, the concept shouldn't be multiplied if not necessary. So I don't know what you think of this. I know that abbreviation, ligature, and brevigraph are three concepts that are historically very connected. There is always an explanation why one thing is abbreviated that way. So it's very, very hard to draw a line when you're actually encoding a writing system, but I think it does make sense. And especially, I think we should not think that since 300 years before it was originally a ligature, then now it's not a brevigraph. It is a brevigraph today. The concept knows this as a global sign, although it historically comes from a ligature. And the other thing is the big, big issue, which is what I asked Arianna. I don't often ask questions during conference. I often say what I think. But now this was a real question. I know it was extremely hard, and I wish you had the answer. I don't know. I mean, we all together can work on the answer, which is how do we connect paleography and philology, however I think we have to, because they're obviously connected when you in the real world, when you do a print edition, and they have to be connected in the digital realm for obvious reasons. Now, one question is, philology is interested, in the best case scenario, in the writing system of the individual witness, because I want to know how that sign makes sense in that writing system, because I'm interested in the meaning of the text, in the sequence of the text. Whereas paleography is interested in Caroline as a whole. And Peter Stock is very ambitious. He wants to go to a transversal paleography. And it also makes sense. However, there are two different scientific needs. Okay, so these are the issues. This is the model. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm looking forward to your feedback.